From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Budget talks between the president and Republican congressional leaders are scheduled to begin shortly at the White House, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta meets with the Republican chairman of the Congressional Budget Committees on Capitol Hill today. He will review progress made by staff at meetings earlier this week. Although some agreements on minor issues have been reached, the big ones, Medicare, Medicaid, and tax cuts, remain. President Clinton is willing to work through the weekend to try to reach a budget compromise. The government shutdown is in its 14th day. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says Congress will not call federal employees back to work until an agreement is reached. There were a few hopeful signs. Senate Republican leaders Bob Dole and Trent Lott have both suggested that a solution that splits the difference between the two sides' plans for Medicare cuts could be possible. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The peace talks between Israel and Syria taking place in Maryland this week were due to recess today for the holidays, but now delegations for the two countries have agreed to remain in the Washington area for what a State Department spokesman calls informal contacts over the weekend. The negotiators had been scheduled to fly home this weekend and return next Wednesday. The change was suggested by U.S. mediators. U.S. Army engineers and helicopter pilots are braving cold and snow in Bosnia to complete assembly of a pontoon bridge across the Sava River between Croatia and Bosnia. The bridge is expected to be finished by tomorrow midday. It will be used by the majority of the American peacekeeping troops headed to the U.S. base in Tuzla. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new drug for cancer that makes use of light activation. Bill Radke of member station KUOW in Seattle reports.
For years, researchers have looked for ways to deal with diseased cells while leaving neighboring cells intact. One tool may be photodynamic or light-activated drugs. The FDA this week gave the okay to a British Columbia-based company to market a drug called Photofrin for use in treating advanced esophageal cancer. QLT Phototherapeutics is based in Vancouver, B.C. Photofrin is injected into a patient and is allowed to circulate and attach itself to tumors, but it has no effect until it's activated by a light source, such as a laser, at which point a chemical reaction destroys the cancer. Photodynamic therapy could be applicable for many diseases involving abnormal cell growth. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
Westinghouse Electric Corporation has introduced a poison pill plan to block any takeover attempts. The Westinghouse board says it's unaware of any current attempt to acquire the company, but some analysts have suggested Westinghouse is a likely target because its stock is relatively cheap and it took on a heavy debt load when it acquired CBS. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 8 points at 5,103. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin returned to the Kremlin today. It was his first full day of work since being hospitalized with a severe heart ailment 2 months ago. Yeltsin said he will not allow the Communist Party, which got most of the votes in the recent parliamentary elections, to turn back the clock and sabotage his reforms. The U.S. government wants public corporations to provide details on the potential risk associated with their holdings in derivatives. The new rules would require companies using derivatives to disclose information about market risk to investors. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Derivatives are complex financial instruments whose values depend on underlying assets such as commodities or currencies. The move toward regulating derivatives was spurred by the huge financial losses incurred by both county governments and corporations that invested heavily in the risky instruments. Orange County, California, filed for bankruptcy last year after sustaining investment losses estimated at $1.6 billion. The Securities and Exchange Commission is proposing that companies using derivatives include information about market risk in their financial reports. The new rules would also require an analysis of a possible loss in earnings, fair values, or cash flows from changes in market rates and prices. The SEC proposal would also have companies describe their accounting policies in footnotes. The agency says it expects the new disclosure requirements to go into effect next year. The SEC will publish them in the Federal Register, after which there will be a 120-day period for public comment. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
North Korea is criticizing GOP presidential hopeful Phil Gramm, calling him a war maniac for saying he would support a preemptive attack on the North if the communist nation persists in developing a nuclear program. North Korea's official newspaper accused Gramm of trying to disrupt a recently signed agreement brokered by the U.S. Under the arrangement, North Korea will cease operation of worrisome nuclear facilities. In exchange, the country will get two modern nuclear reactors less capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we end the year with two of our favorite interviews from our archives, Nicolas Cage and Mel Brooks. Cage is starring in Leaving Las Vegas. The film is on our film critic Stephen Schiff's 10 Best list. Schiff singled out Cage as giving the best performance of the year. Mel Brooks is spoofing vampire films in his new movie Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Also, we remember film director Joseph Vasquez. He launched a promising career with his 1991 film Hangin' with the Homeboys. He died earlier this month of AIDS at the age of 33. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The New York Film Critics Circle and the Los Angeles Film Critics Association both named Nicolas Cage as Actor of the Year for his performance in Leaving Las Vegas, which both groups named as Best Picture of the Year. Since our 1990 interview with Cage is among our favorites, we're featuring it today on this archive edition. In Leaving Las Vegas, Cage plays an alcoholic screenwriter. After losing his job, his money, and his friends to the bottle, he goes to Las Vegas with the intention of drinking himself to death. In Vegas, he meets a prostitute, played by Elizabeth Shue. They fall in love, but he won't let that interrupt his suicide plan. In this scene, she's asked him to move in with her. He tells her she must be crazy.
You haven't seen the worst of it. These last few days, I've been very controlled. But I knock things over and throw up all the time. I mean, right now, I feel really good. You're like some kind of antidote, mixes with the liquor and keeps me in balance. But that won't last forever.
Okay. Don't you like me, Ben?
Sarah, what you don't understand is, no.
What?
You can never, never ask me to stop drinking. Do you understand?
I do. I really do.
Nicolas Cage also starred in the films Red Rock West, Kiss of Death, It Could Happen to You, Honeymoon in Vegas, Wild at Heart, Raising Arizona, Moonstruck, and Vampire's Kiss. Cage is known to go to excessive lengths to prepare for his roles. I asked him if it was true that he pulled out his teeth to prepare for his starring role in the 1984 film Birdie.
Well, actually what happened was I had baby teeth up until I was 22.
Oh.
And they wouldn't come out, so by coincidence, simultaneously, I had to pull the teeth out while I was making Birdie so that the other teeth would come in because they were getting impacted. And I guess people just thought it was some example of wacko method, masochism, which it really wasn't.
Nevertheless, did it help you in the role to experience so much pain? Because
well,
I think
yeah,
that's what
actually,
people assumed it was
figured,
for, yeah.
I figured as long as it's here, might as well use it, you know.
So how did you use it? What does that mean?
Well, if you're experiencing dental pain while you're doing a scene where your face has been blown off, just basically you don't have to act. Just use the dental pain.
Can you tell when you watch the movie back that you were experiencing real pain?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. I don't actually like to watch that movie, to tell you the truth.
Because you don't like the movie?
No, I like the movie. It's just that It was like it was a little private, you know. I let so much stuff come out, and I get a little embarrassed when I see it, just because it's just so bare.
Have you ever gone to real extremes, the equivalent of pulling teeth, to get into a role?
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn while I was working and learn publicly through trial and error, and sometimes I fell on my face and sometimes it worked, but I started at a pretty early age. I started when I was 17, and I really didn't have that much training. So I basically just did all of the things that I'd heard the other great actors had done, like staying up all night to do a scene the next day to look tired, or really doing the method thing. And on Cotton Club, I was playing a pretty crazy gangster who was very feared in Harlem. And I would walk down the street in New York and, you know, smash people's remote control cars and have everything scatter and, you know, really believe I was this psychotic killer. And by the time I was about to do the scene the next day, I brought all that stuff to the scene and it worked. But, you know, needless to say, I wasn't liked very much. And I mean, I do have a life and I don't really want to live the part anymore. So I stopped doing that, and I realized I could get there without all that intense living the role kind of thing.
So what did you do? You smashed remote control cars?
Well, I went down Christopher Street, and there was a guy selling remote control cars for $50, and I said, let me see that, and I put it in the middle of the street, and I jumped on and smashed it, and all the pieces were flying around. All the people just scattered and saying, oh, you're crazy, and all this, and I did give the guy $50 for it, but it just sort of helped me believe that I could create fear in people, which is what that character did in the movie.
You had no confidence that you were really capable of generating fear in somebody before that?
Well, it felt like I was able to, you know. I'm really not a violent guy. I'm not a fighter. I'm not into that. But when I was playing that role, at least at that point, I was young and I was just experimenting with trying to evoke that so that I could believe it in myself or the character. But I've learned that it's just not necessary, and it's actually a lot more creative and thoughtful to just, you know, act the role a little bit sometimes.
Have you ever tried something pretty outrageous in a role and had a director object to it and say that's too far out?
Yeah. I was doing Racing with the Moon, and I've always had this idea of breaking the fourth wall, which is like taking it into hyperrealism, which is what I did in Vampire's Kiss, actually, when I ate the cockroach. I wanted people to know that it was really happening, and to get into that and create that sort of visceral aura. And in Racing with the Moon, I took a pocket knife out and I basically cut my arm open and wanted the blood to go and flow on film and have people know it was a very realistic moment. And Richard Benjamin basically said, wrong movie, Nick, let's cool out a little.
So did he want you to use fake blood, or did he not like that whole idea of self-mutilation anyways?
He just didn't like the idea at all. It wasn't even in the script.
I just wanted to do this one thing,
you know, and try to do something hyper-real. I was experimenting with a lot of different things back then, and I'm glad I did it and went through it, but I do feel like now it's a little bit easier for me to arrive at what is needed in the scene emotionally or in terms of character without doing that intense, self-destructive kind of acting.
Let's talk a little bit about Vampire's Kiss. This is the movie that you referred to before, that you ate the cockroach in. This is a wonderful film. You play a character who is a very obnoxious literary agent, and he thinks he's turning into a vampire because he's gone to bed with someone who he believes bit him, you know, a vampire,
right,
female vampire who he believes bit him. And he starts, you know, shrinking at the sign of the cross and asking people to put a stake through his heart to take him out of his misery. It's an incredibly original performance that you give. It just seemed to me like you must have watched all the new and old horror films to get the classic vampire gestures for the movie.
Well, you know, that's true, actually. I was exposed to the movie Nosferatu at a very early age because my father was, teaching film. And the original Nosferatu, starring Max Schreck, the black and white silent vampire movie, gave me nightmares for years. And those images, especially his body language and his gestures and movements, stayed with me, and I always thought it'd be great to be able to incorporate that kind of silent film acting where they were using their bodies more because they had to compensate for the lack of sound. and try to bring it into modern film. And with Vampire's Kiss, I saw an opportunity to do that, kind of explore that German expressionist style of acting that those guys were doing back then, like in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and even Emil Jannings. And the only way I could pull it off, I figured, was if the character was insane, because you can't really act like that in modern film in a normal format, because people just wouldn't understand or get it or relate to it or want to relate to it. But if the character is insane, and especially if he thinks he's turning into a vampire, there's just a wonderful landscape of things you can do. And so I brought those old style gestures to the character because of his insanity, basically.
Well, one example of the kind of really large gesture that you're talking about is a widening of the eyes. I mean, your eyes get huge in one of the scenes. Did you know you had the capacity to do that with your face?
Well, I experimented in front of a mirror. You know, see, that was what Max Schreck was doing in Nosferatu. His eyes were really wide, and he was just spooky. And I figured it would be kind of cool in one scene to try to freak the secretary, Alva, played by Maria Conchita Alonso, freak her out instead of yelling at her, which was originally what the script called for, just totally yelling at her. There was so much yelling in the movie anyway that I thought it might be more intense to try to use my eyes to freak her out and intimidate her. And I just wanted the eyes to keep getting bigger. And Robert Bierman, the director, staged the camera angle so that the camera would move in slowly into my face as my eyes were getting slowly, progressively bigger and bigger and weirder and spookier. So it was I was pretty happy with that. It was kind of a cool thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to the cockroach eating sequence.
There's
a scene where you're in your kitchen, and this is after you've decided you're turning into a vampire, and there's a cockroach crawling across the burner of the stove, and you scoop it up in your hand and eat it. Now, we don't see you swallow it in the movie, but we do see you chewing on it, and there's no edit, so it's definitely the real thing that's gone in your mouth, I think.
Definitely the real thing. Originally, they wanted me to eat raw eggs, and that didn't do anything for me.
Sylvester Stallone had already done that.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to tie in the Renfield thing, you know, Renfield from the Dracula novel, where he was eating the bugs and stuff. And
Renfield's always the assistant who's in the insane asylum eating insects.
Right, he's the assistant to Dracula. And it was a slow progression for Peter Lowe. I mean, first he's eating pistachios, then he's eating a cockroach, then he finally eats the dove and ultimately bites a girl's neck and kills her and drinks her blood. So it was like this progressive building from pistachio to girl. And the cockroach was one of the steps in the disintegration of Peter Lowe. So I said, you know, I want to try eating a cockroach. And everybody was like, you've got to be crazy. And I said, yeah, I know what you mean. I really don't like cockroaches myself. And they wrangled up three New York cockroaches out of somebody's basement. And the day arrived where I had to do it, and I saw the bug when I walked on the set, and the legs were kicking and the antennas were going, and it looked huge. And I almost said, guys, I can't do it. And I figured that would be a cop-out because, you know, I'd set it up and made them wrangle for cockroaches for weeks. And, I put the cockroach close to me, and every muscle in my body was just saying, don't do it. And the wings were going, and then I did it, and I couldn't sleep for about 3 days, and I couldn't eat, but, well, I did it, and there it is. You know what I mean?
Did you call a doctor first and ask if chewing a cockroach could kill you?
No, yeah, they said it would be okay. What I did was I rinsed my mouth out with 100-proof vodka and sterilized my mouth before I did it. And then when I spat the cockroach out, I sterilized it again.
What did it taste like?
Oh, you know, I couldn't remember. All I know is it was soft. It was not crunchy. It was soft, and it was just a nightmare.
Does it ever come back and haunt you?
Well, when I talk about it like this and I start thinking about it, I get goosebumps. I mean, I'm starting to get the willies again.
Huh. No, but don't you collect exotic insects and animals?
Well, I like exotic fish. I like anything to do with the ocean, and I'm not really a bug fan. I mean, I have a 4-foot perfect, highly detailed model of a wasp in my living room that I stare at on occasion, but I don't really have a huge bug collection, no.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Nicolas Cage. He's currently starring in the film Leaving Las Vegas. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Nicolas Cage is my guest. Several of your early films were directed by Francis Ford Coppola, who's actually your uncle. Rumblefish, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Cotton Club. You're a Coppola, but you changed your name to Cage. When did you change it, and why did you do it?
Well, when I first started working, I made a couple of TV shows, and I went in to read the other actors for Rumblefish, and by my surprise, they said, well, we'd like you to be in the movie. And, you know, then I was still Nicolas Coppola, and I felt a lot of pressure from the other actors, you know, Mickey and Matt, and basically them thinking I didn't have the goods because I was just a case of nepotism. And it kind of made me a little stiff, you know. I felt a lot of that pressure. So when I changed my name, I felt like I was brand new. I went in to read for a movie called Valley Girl, and it was the first time that I'd auditioned for a movie where the casting lady wasn't talking for a half an hour about the movies that my uncle had made and totally taking my mind off the scene that I had prepared for 2 days, you know? So it really helped me out to change the name, and it took the pressure off of me, and I felt a lot freer.
Why did you choose Cage as your last name?
Well, there's a long time ago, I used to read a lot of comic books, and there was a superhero, and his name was Luke Cage, Power Man. And I just thought it was a cool-sounding name, and then I was listening to John Cage's music, which I found very stimulating, and I just decided to use it. And there were a couple other names that I was going to go for, but it just sounded right to me. It was just sort of simple and to the point.
You have, I've read, a tattoo of a lizard on your back.
Right.
I mean, when you see your back looking in a two-way mirror or something, doesn't it give you the creeps?
No, I that's part of the reason why I put it on my back. I really don't see it that often.
Well, why did you put it there?
Well, it was Halloween 1984, and I broke up with my girlfriend. I was just feeling like I had to do something radical. And when I look back on it, I was 20 years old at the time, and I guess I was getting ready to become a man, and it was like my way of saying I'm my own person, and I'm breaking free of the family, and I was the first one in the family to get a tattoo. So I guess in retrospect, it was kind of a walkabout, if you will, or a bar mitzvah.
How did you show it to your family?
Well, I remember I just said, Dad, I got a tattoo, and I lifted up my shirt, and he saw it, and his face went white, and he had himself a martini, and that was that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Nicolas Cage recorded in 1990. The New York Film Critics Circle named him Actor of the Year for his performance in his current film, Leaving Las Vegas. On the soundtrack, Sting performs a song made famous by Frank Sinatra, Angel Eyes. On the recent TV tribute to Sinatra, Angel Eyes was sung by Bruce Springsteen. I thought you'd enjoy hearing the song performed by its composer, Matt Dennis. He's also featured at the piano.
Thank you. try to think that love's not around. Still it's uncomfortably near. My old heart ain't gaining no ground since my angel eyes ain't here. Angel eyes that old devil sent, they glow unbearably bright. Need I say that my love's misspent, misspent with angel eyes tonight. So drink up all you people, order anything you see, have fun, you happy people, the drink and the laughs on me. Pardon me, but I gotta run. The fact's uncommonly clear. I gotta find who's now number one and why my angel eyes ain't here. So drink up, all you people. Order anything you see. Have fun, you happy people. The drink and the laughs on me. Pardon me, but I gotta run. The fact's uncommonly clear. I gotta find who's now number one and why my angel eyes ain't here. Excuse me while I disappear.
Matt Dennis singing his song Angel Eyes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Mel Brooks spoofs vampire films in his new movie, Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Coming up, an interview from our archives in which Mel Brooks tells us why he'd rather be Fred Astaire. Also, we remember Joseph Vasquez, director of the 1991 film Hangin' with the Homeboys. He died of AIDS earlier this month at the age of 33. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1991, we spoke with a young screenwriter and director named Joseph Vasquez, who was attracting attention for his film Hangin' with the Homeboys. We thought he was a promising director, and we enjoyed his sense of humor in the interview. We were sad to learn that he died earlier this month at the age of 33 of AIDS. We remember him now with a short excerpt of our interview. Hangin' with the Homeboys was a comic drama about four friends from the South Bronx. One of them was played by John Leguizamo in one of his first roles. The friends spend a Friday night crashing parties, getting into fights, jumping subway turnstiles, and trying to pick up girls. Two of the friends are Latino, two are black. One of them, Willie, is unemployed and always sponging off his friends. Here he is with his social worker.
Look, Mr. Stevens, we're quite fed up with your behavior. We've sent you out to several work programs, and you never show up. If you don't want your welfare checks terminated, you'd better straighten up.
This is because I'm black, right?
What are you talking about?
Look, you can be honest with me. You're doing this to me because I'm black, right?
Fine. I'll be honest. I'm doing this because I think you're a bum.
Oh, I'm a bum. You call me a bum because I'm black, right? See, if I was a white guy, I'd be eccentric. But now I gotta be a bum, right?
No, if you were a white guy, you'd be a white bum.
Now, there's a character in the movie who he's African American, and he keeps saying to people whenever he doesn't get what he wants, "You're doing this to me because I'm black."
Right.
Where does that come from?
Lately, it sounds like Spike Lee at the Cannes Film Festival. where does that come from? It comes from a lot of people that I've met in my neighborhood, and also, you know, I can also credit my uncle to part of that, who's now dead. Because you know, there was a thing, like, when I was working in editing houses, he was like, "Oh, you're going over there to work for the white man, huh?" And this and that, and, you know, and don't ever trust the white man, and this and all this philosophy, and, you know, and on the other hand, you know, you're saying about how they hold you down and this and that, but it's like, I look at my uncle, and it's like, what have you done for yourself, you know? The guy really didn't do much to get his life together on his own. So, I mean, how can you blame anybody? I mean, the funny thing is half the time that the white man isn't even thinking about you. They don't give a damn. You know, they're like, "Hey, you go about your business. I couldn't care less." So,
can you put your finger on which movies you saw that made you really want to make movies yourself?
Everybody asks me that question, and there's tons of movies that I love, but a movie didn't really make me want to make movies. What made me want to make movies was a cousin of mine when I was about 10, 11, gave a home movie camera to my brothers as a present, like a Christmas present. And, you know, they shot like one film with it and put it down and were bored. And I was just fascinated by the thing with the lenses on it, and, you know, and you could change lenses and you can open it up and load film, and, you know, and you can shoot something and have it forever, and you know, and your vision, you can cut off people's vision, you know, you can show them only what you want them to see, and then all of a sudden you pan over and then they'll see something totally different that, you know, they didn't even know was in the frame, you know. So that's what fascinated me, was the camera rather than, you know, films that were being made.
Yeah. Did you go to the movies a lot when you were growing up?
Yeah, I went to the movies a whole lot, and I was the kind of kid who stayed up at, you know, 12 o'clock looking at the Late Late Show, and I'd go in school and be sleeping through the whole class. And the teacher would go, "You gotta go to bed earlier." And I was like, "Yeah, but Betty Grable was on last night." And, you know.
So. What were the theaters like in your neighborhood? Because I know that where I live, for instance, in Center City, there's a lot of theaters that are really mostly like for teenagers.
Right.
And
it's the same. That was the kind of theater. Matter of fact, that theater that you're talking about with teenagers and that is the same theater that right now is showing Homeboys.
Well, those theaters are usually like a disaster. They're not clean.
Oh, they're not clean. And the sound is terrible.
The sound is terrible. The projection's terrible. And, yeah. And no one's going to fix it.
That's the theater.
Right. And yeah. And then the bathrooms are really dangerous, right?
Yeah, that's the theater. You got it. And I worked in that theater for a short while, too, when I was in college. Like, when I was a kid, I went there and saw the karate movies and mm-hmm. saw all the black movies, Shaft and Superfly meets the Wolfman, whatever. You know, I saw all those movies there.
Well, you know, another thing is during the movies, people are always, like, talking.
Oh, yeah, they're yelling at the screen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
"What do you mean, man?" You know, the character on screen says, you know, "I love you." And it's like, "Oh, man, forget her." You know, yelling at the screen. Yeah, that's the theater.
So would that bother you when you were really getting caught up in a movie and everybody's yelling at the screen and breaking the spell?
No, because I was usually the one that started it.
Really?
Yeah, I was the guy sitting in the front row. "What do you mean you love her?" You know? "Forget her." You know? I was part of it. That was going to a movie in the Bronx. I mean, as a matter of fact, the first time I went to a movie at a really classy theater in Manhattan, it was really funny. I was like, everybody's quiet. What's going on? Nobody's talking. What is this? You know? And then, you know, and then I remember going to, like, a year later after that experience, going to a theater, and the projector, like, you know, stopped or something, a frame burned or whatever, you know, when it was technical difficulty.
Uh-huh.
And everybody was pretty quiet and pretty patient. But, you know, I was such in a habit of being in my neighborhood theater when that happened. You go, yo! Hey! So, you know, I would do that, and people just turned around and looked at me like, what is this guy's problem? You know, and I was like 15 or something. You know?
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So I guess it doesn't bother you now if one of your movies is on screen and people are yelling up things at the screen.
No, because that's the way they enjoy it in their particular environment, you know? So, hey, if they're yelling, it's because they're enjoying it. When they're quiet, it's because they hate it over there.
Now, I read it in an article about you that on your way to a New York film critics screening of Hanging with the Homeboys, you were busted.
Yeah.
And it was, mistaken identity or something?
Yeah.
What happened?
The cops were really stupid. They walked up to me and they said, where are you coming from? And I'm standing there with this little old lady, my grandmother, you know, to go down to a screening of the film. And they said, where'd you just come from? And I said, my grandmother's house. And then God, I don't even remember. It's like I tried to block most of it out. But they then grabbed me and threw me up against a wall and threw handcuffs on me because I said something like, what? Get away from me, man. You got no reason to be coming up to me. So at that point, they got very hostile. And that was it. Then they threw me in a police car. My grandma's like, can I get him in the police car with him? She was going hysterical, having a heart attack. And they were like, no, you can't. And they just threw me in a police car and closed the doors and took me downtown. And then the funny part of it is when I'm in the jail cell, and the cop comes up to me, you know, because I'm complaining. I'm saying, you're a real idiot, you know that? I mean, you know I did nothing wrong and this and that. And he comes up to me, he goes, look, man, you got to understand. We were looking for a guy with blue pants. I said, listen. He says, we were looking for a guy with blue pants. And I said, I got on black pants. Then he goes, look, he was a dark-skinned Hispanic. I said, I'm a light-skinned Hispanic. He goes, look, he had these white sneakers on. I said, I got black sneakers on. He goes, there's no talking to you. There's no talking to you, you know. So that was the funniest part of it all.
Joseph Vasquez wrote and directed the 1991 film Hanging with the Homeboys. He died earlier this month of AIDS. He was 33. Our interview was recorded in 1991. Coming up, an interview with Mel Brooks. This is Fresh Air. What's more tasteless than turning the Spanish Inquisition into a lavish song and dance number? How about a Broadway musical saluting Adolf Hitler? These are the kinds of insane spectacles that fans like me love Mel Brooks for. Think of the contributions he's made to American comedy. He was a writer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. He created The 2,000-Year-Old Man with Carl Reiner. He co-created the TV series Get Smart and made such movies as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, History of the World Part 1, and High Anxiety. Now he's parodying vampire films in his new movie, Dracula, Dead and Loving It. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring our 1991 interview with Mel Brooks. Let's start with a song he wrote for his comedy, The Producers, a film about two Broadway producers who come up with a convoluted scheme to get rich quick by producing the worst musical ever made, Springtime for Hitler.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master.
to some of my very favorite Mel Brooks moments are your big production numbers, your Broadway showstoppers with big choruses for grim and totally inappropriate subjects like Springtime for Hitler and the Producers, or The Inquisition, What a Show, and History of the World, Part 1. Did you want to be on Broadway for real when you were growing up, or did you want to be a song and dance man?
To be perfectly frank, yes. The answer to all those questions is yes, yes! I wanted more than anything. I wanted to sing and dance and jump up and down on Broadway, and even more than that, on the big silver screen. And my heroes when I was young were, of course, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. And I loved all those great old black and white musicals like The Gay Divorcee and Top Hat and the color movies that MGM made with Gene Kelly, you know, fantastic. And I loved Singing in the Rain. I mean, who doesn't love a great musical? And in all of my movies, whether it's proper or not, I squeeze in a number, you know?
So when you were growing up and you really wanted to be on Broadway or to be a song and dance man, how far did you get with that? Or how far did you think you could get singing and dancing? Did you have...
Oh, I did it. But I did it in the sour cream factories of the Borscht Belt and the Catskills, just outside of New York. There were these resort hotels. And you started by just tending the rowboats or being a busboy, and you prayed to end up on stage, you know, in a variety show on Saturday night. And I became a drummer, and I got onto the stage because the comic got sick. So the boss, Pincus Cohen, redundant name, he didn't need both Pincus and Cohen. One would have been, said, used to call me Melbum, M-E-L-B-M-N-N-N-N. He'd say, Melbum, the comic is sick, and we know you're cute and funny, so jump on the stage and amuse the guests. So that night I went on the stage, and I never went back to the drums.
What'd you do that night?
Well, that night I did a different... It's a good question, Terry. I like you, Terry Gross. This is going to be a great show because I like you and I like me. So when I listen to this, I'm going to be in heaven, you know. What did I do? That night I did a different kind of comedy because there was a maid who was locked in the closet that day. She had somehow locked herself in a broom closet, in a storeroom closet, and she couldn't get out. And she was pounding on the door and screaming in Yiddish, "Lass mir reis! Lass mir reis!" and screaming. And finally somebody heard her, opened the door, and let her out. So they let Sophie out, and she had a little attack of tears and nerves, and then went back to taking care of the rooms. So and everybody at the place knew it. It was like a scandal. Poor Sophie, ay, ay, ay. So when the first thing I did that night, I said, "Good evening, ladies and Jews." You know, I did my company. And I said, "Los mi arise!" I just screamed, and the place went, it was pandemonium, you know, because they knew about it. And I decided to do like real comedy, people's comedy, or comedy that everybody knew instead of making up, quote, jokes. And I've been doing that kind of comedy ever since.
I want to get back to your big lavish production numbers like Springtime for Hitler. What possessed you the first time you did one of those? Like Springtime for Hitler, for instance. It's such a wonderful and really funny number, and I'm sure a lot of people thought it was just in horrible taste.
It was in horrible taste. It was in execrable taste. I'm ashamed of it to this day, but... but I do like that juxtaposition of those two textures, you know. But let me tell you, the song itself, composed, but nobody knows I wrote the music as well as made up those words. So I wrote the words and the music to Springtime for Hitler. The song is beautiful. People listen to it even today, and they don't know it's Springtime for Hitler. They listen to the orchestration, or they listen to the non-vocal version of it. In many cities, I was just in Chicago, there is an elevator playing Springtime for Hitler.
Really?
And there are people going up and down, but it just goes da-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da. They don't know it's Springtime for Hitler and Germany. They don't know that. They just hear the music and they sway till they get to the 22nd floor, you know. And it's amazing. And so the melody is almost like a Richard Rodgers melody, and that's why when you hear these crazy words against it, it all falls into place beautifully.
We're featuring an interview from our archives with Mel Brooks. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Georgie Brown. Ja w sierpniu będę w niebie. Sweet Georgie Brown, below dobrze znasz. Te co pewnie masz, okej. Mój kolega mnie ostrzega, ratuj się pan. Ona z każdym panem ważnym, ten co ma plan. Będzie biło serce twoje, bliżej bracie zdrowie swoje. Georgie bija, Georgie żyja, sweetie pretty Georgie Brown.
Back with Mel Brooks. What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten if you weren't writing your own?
Oh, my favorite role would be the King of Germany, the Kaiser role. That would be, no. Two demerits for that. I can't help. Look, when you work in the mountains, it never leaves you. You know, cheap jokes, cheap jokes. I mean, I'm a purveyor of cheap jokes. Now, what kind of roles would I say again, Terry?
What kind of roles do you think you would have gotten in movies if you weren't writing your own?
Well, in the 30s, I probably would have been a bellboy in hotel movies, you know. And then I guess in the 40s, I would have been, you know, like a good-natured soldier from Brooklyn. I know the roles they would have given me. They would have called me Brooklyn. Hey, Brooklyn, you know. And then in the 50s, I would have been the band boy with the rock and roll group, you know, touring. That's why I wrote these movies, you know, or else I would have been stuck with all these parts. I would have been called Blinky and Winky and Nod.
Before you started writing for the Sid Caesar Show, did you have any outwardly Jewish people to see yourself in, outside of the Catskill comics, but people who were not only Jewish in show business, but were doing sketches about being Jewish, or who were writing stories about being Jewish, or, you know, who were Jewish in any outward way?
Good question. No. The only role models had gone away, and that was Yiddish theater.
Right.
Yiddish theater of Second Avenue in New York. And that was long gone by the time I had made my way into show business. I had only seen one play. And the second act of the Yiddish theater was an incredible device. It was great. It was the most emotional point in the play. This is the second act curtain I'm talking about, before you went into the third act. This is to hold the audience so they would sit for the third act. And the daughter would come home to them. She was missing, and she would come home. And she would enter stage left, and the mother was stage right looking at her. And she would open her coat, and she would show this big belly. And the mother would scream in Yiddish, "Er ist schwanger!" And she'd faint, and the curtain would come down. And that is, the mother would say, "She's pregnant." So, and they always had, or a soldier would come home, and the mother would say, "It is blind. He's blind." And then the curtain would come. I mean, they always had this. They had these tragically emotional moments. And I learned that somehow, at the end of the second act, and I do that in all my movies, you've got to hook the people so they're excited about at least the denouement. I mean, the rush to the end, you know?
Can I hear about what your bar mitzvah was like?
It was fast and short. In those days, they were not. Today, I just went to a bar mitzvah, and it could have fed all of Kiev, where my mother came from. It's an amazing difference. My bar mitzvah took 15 minutes, and the kids threw hard candy, and a couple of them hit me with it, and it was all over. And, of course, I'll never forget the breath of my Rebbe. I mean, Rebbe breath is famous. I mean, they eat garlics and onions, and then they try to teach you Hebrew. And they would breathe in your face and say, "No, not chu, not." And it was quite an experience. And ask any little Jewish kid who's bar mitzvahed about Rebbe breath.
A lot of your movies are parodies of genre films. When did you fall in love with movies? Did you go a lot when you were young?
I went a lot, and I didn't have a lot of money. So the way I used to get into movies was when the audience, when the movie would break and the audience would walk out, I would join them, and I would walk backwards until I was in the theater.
Oh, so it looked like you were exiting.
In the back row,
yeah.
And then when the new audience came in, I mean, I would watch the movie, and that was the only way I could get to see movies, because I couldn't afford the whatever it was, the 15 cents to get in to see them. And my mother used to search for me in the movies, because I would see the same movie, you know, if it was Top Hat or the gay divorce, forget about it. I'd see it 16 times. I knew every step. I knew every nuance, every lilt, every note, every fill. I was addicted. I was addicted to movies.
I want to get back to something we were talking about before. You know how you were saying if you weren't writing your own roles, you'd be like the bellboy in the movie or whatever. When you realized that as much as you loved song and dance and Broadway shows and musical comedy movies, when you realized that you probably weren't going to be a leading man, you weren't going to be cast as a leading man, well, eventually you started casting yourself as a leading man in parodies of those kinds of movies. But were you ever really heartbroken knowing that you wouldn't be in the serious versions of those movies?
That's a good question, yeah. In my heart of hearts, I always wanted to be Errol Flynn. Yeah, I was heartbroken. And I always wanted the most beautiful, long-waisted, long-legged women in the world to fall on their knees and pray to me. But as life and God would have it, it was the other way around. Every time I see a tall, beautiful woman, I just crash to my knees and I pray to her. I say, please, just give me a slap in the face, something. Show me that you know I'm alive too. I made myself a leading man in High Anxiety because I always wanted to imitate Frank Sinatra. So here was a chance to write a song called High Anxiety and sing it at a bar, which was a dream of mine. And I made myself, a leading man because in real life I knew I could never be a leading man.
Well, I'm going to play some of High Anxiety.
Oh, thanks, Tara. High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly. It's crashed before. But then you take my hand, my heart starts to soar. Once more, high anxiety, it's always the same. Anxiety, it's you that I blame. It's very clear to me I've got to give in. High anxiety, you win.
Our interview with Mel Brooks was recorded in 1991. Well, this is our last show for 1995. Let's end it with a Mel Brooks song that you might keep in mind as you face 1996. The song is from the Brooks film The 12 Chairs. It's called Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst.
Hope for the best.
Expect the worst. Some drink champagne, some die of thirst.
That was splendid.
Then he died the day he planned
to go and spend it
shouting, "If I are alive, no one will survive.
Life is sorrow,
here today and gone tomorrow.
If I are alive, no one will survive.
There's no guarantee.
Hope for the best,
expect the worst.
I knew a man.
Hope for the best, expect the worst. Lyrics by Mel Brooks. I want to wish you a happy and healthy new year from everyone who worked on Fresh Air this year. Our full-time and part-time staff, our staff who has moved on, our interns, volunteers, and our leaders here at WHYY. Happy New Year from Dorothy Farabee, Fred Landerl, Danny Miller, Marty Moscowain, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Roberta Shurrock, Alan Tu, Barbara Bogave, Tina Brock, Lisa Bruton, Nancy Greenlease, Chris Spurgeon, Tracy Tannenbaum, Joan Tui Westman, Nancy Updike, Sue Weinstein, Kathy Wolf, Rena Bander, Becky Cohn, Kenesha Baker, Sienna Chrisman, Zeb Esselstein, Sipporah Lubar, Louise Stanton, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Bob Balls, Chris Fraley, Richard Parker, Fred Snyder, Art Ellis, Rick Breitenfeld, Fred Brown, and David Othmer. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. Talk to you again in 96. On the next Fresh Air, we begin the new year with two men who have pondered life's mysteries from a Buddhist perspective. Geshe Thupten Jinpa is the Dalai Lama's translator. Tenzin Shogyal is the Dalai Lama's youngest brother. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.